This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sevisodhi. It's Friday and, of course, Dr. George Lee in the studio with me, together with Dr. Prashant Nadkarni. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Nice to be here.
Good afternoon. It's a very hot day, isn't it?
It is very
And the topic today is going to heat up even more discussion.
It is. Okay, so let's dive into it. After we have a quick discussion about what's your thoughts on this particular case, we'll have Sharon Palani, our medical legal expert, who will join us on the telephone later on to find out the legal aspects of this whole case. Right, George, so you picked out a case in the UK where a 20-plus-year-old girl actually had ovarian cancer. She froze her eggs in the process before she actually went through treatment, and she happened to die. She didn't quite survive. And according to her mum, her wish was for her mother to actually get that egg fertilized and for her mother to be the surrogate mother for that embryo.
Yeah.
So then now what's happened is the UK is not allowing that.
That's right, okay.
And well, she wants to go to the US to actually get this done. And there's a hospital in the US that's happy to do it for her. But there are some issues as far as cross-border, moving these embryos cross-border as well because of different legislation in different countries. So we're going to be discussing that.
It's complicated.
So very heavy, especially after Chinese New Year. But since everybody's back in business, why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I promised Dr. Prashant that, you know, we're going to deal with these problems of what Dr. Jean Wu calls the garden of embryos.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, okay. So imagine.
What is he doing?
Well, okay, let me explain myself, right? Okay. I'm a urologist, yes. So I deal with those little sperms, and then okay, Dr. Prashant actually deals with those little eggs, and then we have these kind of like a combinations of these embryos, and a lot of them being used, some of them are not being used, but and then some people just drag on for many, many years, and so Dr. Prashant has somewhere in his lab a lot of these frozen eggs, sperms, and also embryos. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're talking about. Because one day, we were having a discussion. I can't remember.
It was some time ago.
Okay. Dr. Jean Wu, I kind of on the way said, I'm going to talk to your colleague. And then Dr. Jean Wu kind of said to me, oh, ask Dr. Prashant what he does with the garden of embryo. And then at the back of my mind, I just have that vision of his lab having all those garden of embryo. Would you like
to
explain
this? Do you
really,
Dr. Prashant? Obviously, a lot of the embryos are not used up.
Well, not just embryos, right? They are just sperms and eggs.
There's embryos, a whole pile of things. All of them capable of giving you a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the ethics. This is the problem. A, you don't know which, if any, is going to give you. But in general, what you've got is life sitting in your freezer tanks.
Frozen life.
Wow.
So you just can't make a decision yourself. You can't say, look, I know I'm fed up. I haven't heard from them. I'm going to throw them away. It is life.
You can't do that because technically, I mean, from what I'm understanding from, let's, you know, recently I had one guy who had testicular cancer.
Mm.
And then, you know, we asked him to freeze his sperm first because it's very likely that he will require chemotherapy. And we don't really know whether he will recover or not. And he asked me many questions. He said, look, how long am I going to keep it for? How much does it cost? And then do I have to carry on paying? Will someone contact me? And then what happens if I don't pay? Do they throw away? So we should like to explain a little bit about how that is being carried out once I sent those specimens to you.
Okay. Sorry. I think the first thing is counseling. Patients need to understand what they're doing. Cancer is an easy one because they are quite aware that there is no guarantee that they themselves will live. And you need to get all those consents up front.
Right.
So if a single man comes in, he doesn't have a partner.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell him, look, we're freezing this because we don't know what happens after your treatment. Your either the surgery, the cancer, or the chemotherapy may actually render you completely sterile.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have a chance with your sperm with us. Now, when we freeze that sperm, we tell them, it's for you. And as long as you're alive, and as long as you can give me consent,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that you want this sperm used for your wife when you get married in the future. If something happens to you and you don't survive this cancer, I need your consent now that this will be destroyed.
Or what do you want to do with it?
Is that an option?
The Malaysian Medical Council here, and in general all over the world, to prevent this sort of problem that you're seeing now, actually gets consent up front to say it will be destroyed. Well, unless they particularly insist that they want it used.
Mm.
And then normally we say, with whom? So give us a name. So you can't just someone later on down the road coming and saying, you know, I'm his third cousin, and then I find someone. And you don't want all of that.
Okay, right.
So you want a name. It's actually, you know, in the UK, we tell them, put it in your will. Will it to someone if you want it given away. But be specific. Don't say, I want to have children. Well, you're dead and gone. You want to have children. Well, you know, you're not here anymore.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, this is going to contradict a lot of this case that we're talking about. Yeah. Before we do that, so that man who comes to see you, I mean, he obviously have to pay these kind of
yearly... Not much. It's about 350 ringgit.
That's it per year.
And I'll give you a story, a simple one.
Okay.
Oh, so it costs 350
It's just storage
per
fees.
Annum.
Yeah, per year.
Every year. Yeah. Okay.
I think it costs about 500 to freeze and then about 350 to keep. They're not very expensive for sperm. And this happened to me about 5 years ago. A colleague sent, an oncologist sent, a young man who had testicular cancer. He had a leukemia. And he came with his father, his mother, and his girlfriend. And we said, look, this is it. And when you pass away by law, you need to understand that this cannot be used for your partner.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody agreed, all consented.
That's Malaysian law.
Well, it's not law yet, but medical council guidelines.
Okay.
So all finished, and I didn't see them. And then last year, the father came back and said, I'm sorry to tell you, but my son didn't make it. So the sperm's here, and his girlfriend is willing to carry the child.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, God.
They weren't married.
I'm against. I made him sign a consent. He's agreed that they are to be destroyed. He didn't say anything at that point. Now we're facing exactly the same situation that we're going to discuss.
Well, okay. Let me explain a little bit about Mrs. M. Okay, Mrs. M actually has a daughter in benefit of the court. It's called A. A was raised in London and then was actually raised in Hammersmith. And Hammersmith actually has the oncology department, which is the postgraduate department, and also have fertility centre that's attached to it. In fact, that's Lord Winston's department, right? Mm. Okay, and in the consent, what the court said, well, A had bowel cancer, and then A had the treatment of bowel cancer done, and then 3 years later, didn't quite make it, and then went to the States. The family's from US, and in New York, she passed away there. And as a result of this, the discussion was that they wanted the egg, just the egg, to be used in a surrogate person in New York, and with a payment of $60,000 to surrogate this egg and then to get a donor sperm to do that. And that is a first, apparently. What is interesting is that in the consent, that A actually signed a consent to say that I give consent for this to be frozen, but there's a second form that actually say that if I sign that consent, I give consent to my father or my mother to decide what to do. And I didn't realize that existed. Now, that was an interesting thing. So the argument from the lawyer said this is a disproportionate interference with the family human rights because it is simply forgot to sign a second form. But I always assume it is like what you said, that it is purely once you are dead, you actually cannot instruct. How do you instruct anyway once you're dead to actually say, I want to be specific on how that is being used?
Would you entertain that?
In this country, no, because the medical council is clear. So as it happened, I said, look, this is the consent and all of you were here.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed. So I'm sorry, I can't do anything. If at all, you'll need to take it to the courts. And a few months later, the daughter, I think, lost interest and found someone else. Or the girlfriend lost interest, found someone else. And so in the second year, the father came and said...
Made your life easier.
I came and said, look, you know, now I don't have anyone. What can I do about it? And I said, well, you can thaw and let it go. He thought about it and then they thought and let it go.
Right.
So that's first. But in the UK, what we used to tell people is, if you really want to do something with your eggs or sperm, put it in your will. It becomes part of your estate and then it becomes easier for us to read through and say, okay, I will my sperm to so-and-so or whatever. And then we're fine. The doctors are in the clear. But we don't want to be in breach of ethics. And that's the issue. It's not that the doctors are being obstructive. You are creating life. But the problem is science moves faster than ethics. So there are lots of things we can do.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to work within a society. and it's what society accepts. So in this country, the MMC guideline says you have to be a married couple. So we have to follow that. And in other countries, same-sex couple have children. So that's fine. So it is what your society says. The case you're discussing this morning is not about embryos. It's about eggs.
Yeah, it's about eggs.
It's about
and
eggs.
It's a mother who says that the daughter told her
that's right.
that you should be the surrogate. Now, most people won't say to your 59-year-old mother that you should be the person who carries the baby.
That's
you'd say, find me a surrogate. So part of it hinges on the fact that no one else heard this conversation except the dead daughter and the mother who says this
so
is
would
true.
It make
I'm just
any
trying
difference?
To imagine. God, it's not a nice thought, really. Is it possible for a postmenopausal woman to surrogate?
Yes,
be the surrogate
we can
mother.
Do it.
You can.
This is a challenge, but yes.
But
doctors look for George.
Even if it's your own daughter's, even if it's your own daughter's egg.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, now we're getting into
genetics
really.
Genetics got nothing to do with it.
Well, it's just a room, right? It's just a room for
it's space, well controlled, and it will. You know, yeah. We do.
Okay.
The oldest mother who had a baby, I think, was.
You know what
something.
We need to do? We need to open the conversation to Klang Valley just to ask people, what do you think about this situation? You know, technically, are we playing God here?
Yeah. And that's why you need courts and you need ethics committees, and that's why the doctors have asked someone else to decide. Because it can be done. It's a matter of should it be done? And is this within the norms of the society that they live in? Even in the UK, they're asking this question.
So we have several questions here. You know, number one is that is this court being disproportionately unsympathetic? You know, because after all, it's a young lady who lost her life and wanted her legacy to carry on, regardless of whether science can actually carry on that or not. So the court rejected that. You know, is that right or is that wrong? The second thing is that, you know, if the mother wants to carry a child, you know, surrogacy using your mother, and you carry your own daughter's embryo or eggs that is fertilized by a donor. Is that a little bit of a mess?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Who's the mother then?
Who is the mother? Yeah, who's the mother?
It's the same as a surrogate, right? Who's the mother? By law, the person who delivered the baby is the mother.
Oh, now
so
we're
the grandmother will be the mother.
Okay, I love the part now. Is surrogacy even legal in this country?
No.
No.
And so we don't do
right.
it.
Is it practiced in any country? Is it even legal in any countries?
Legal means there's a law that says you can do it.
That's right.
So in most countries, if there's no law, then it's not illegal, right?
But in
there
our
must
country,
be a law before you break it and then it becomes illegal. So if you go to many countries, there's no law. And so it is not illegal and it's done. And you know.
So we have no law.
Well, we have a guideline.
Well, we've got
a small group of
doctors
and we all tend to keep within that. So Malaysia is fine. But some of our neighboring countries are not.
I'm going to ask Sharon later, is that what is guideline and what is law? And then where do you stand when it comes to that line?
Okay, what this whole talk about family human rights as well? I mean, what does that even mean?
Well, I think in this context, the 59-year-old grandmother says, it is my right to do...
To have the...
Correct.
To be the surrogate
but
mother.
Correct. I'm not 100% sure actually the mother offered to surrogate. And in fact, they actually found someone to actually offer to surrogate. Does that make any difference?
I don't know. I mean, she expressed... I mean, for me, it was verbal. She said she wanted her mother to carry the child. And it was a verbal understanding. That can be a problem, I suppose, in a legal sense. So we're going to get Sharon to, hopefully, after this, help us understand some of this the laws. And we'll come back to surrogacy, Dr. Prashant, and how it actually works. What are the prerequisites to be a surrogate mother? I mean, can you be really old and be a surrogate mother? And you did say the oldest lady was how old again?
The oldest lady to get pregnant and have a child, I think, was 74.
Right.
Are you serious?
Wow. But she used somebody else's egg. Her own, I mean, she was not a surrogate. She borrowed an egg from a younger person and then had a child.
But still, everything else is working. Everything
for her,
else
yes,
is in
she'd
order.
Had her assessment. Everything was seen to be working. And she had a baby, so clearly it was working.
How do you get an atrophied uterus to actually start functioning again to nurture a fetus?
An atrophied uterus, meaning it's a dead
shrunk
uterus?
Down. No, it's just shrunk down because of so many years of not having menses.
Not used. Okay.
Correct. We give them estrogens and progesterones, and we just prime it. And after 2 or 3 months, it starts functioning again.
Really?
Wake up from the dead.
See it.
wake up from the
atrophy. You just make it seem like, you know, it can be done.
No, as I keep saying, science can do many things.
You know,
the question is that what society wants you to do? And that's where this keeps popping up for discussion.
We're going to get phone calls to say, it can be done, but should it be done?
Should it be done?
Yes.
Right.
So give us a call. The number is 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 0162019000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me for his Friday show. You won't be around for the next 2 weeks.
That's
you?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. Getting a bit emotional today with this.
I can see your face.
So that's right.
Why do you feel so? I mean, you're the one who suggested this for us to discuss this article.
I think there's a lot of discrepancy when it comes to cases like this. I think certain courts will grant, certain courts won't grant this, and then it's really unfair because I'm going to talk about Diane Blood case, which a dead husband's sperm was granted being used. Okay. So I'm going to talk about that later.
Sure. Hi, Sharon, are you there? Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Can you hear Sharon clearly, gentlemen?
Yeah.
You can. Yes. Okay. Sharon, we've got tons of questions for you regarding that case of the lady who froze her eggs and wanted her mother to actually be the surrogate mother after she passed on because of bowel cancer. What did you think of the case, Sharon?
Just like what the article says, it's the world's first. I think it's quite a... Well, for me, personally, I think it's a serious matter because... Number one is the mother's age. That's my concern. But like what Prashant said, that, you know, if women can have it up to 74, then that's really medical view. But in terms of legally in Malaysia, I think that if you look at what the daughter tried to do, if it's going to be here, I think we're going to have a little bit of difficulty. It's never tested before, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then again, it'll depend on who is coming before the doctor. If it's a Muslim mother, it's going to be totally different. Fatwas in place, so that's going to be a bit different.
Okay, there are three things I wanted to ask you about this case. One is, of course, who owns the egg?
The daughter.
It's the daughter, and as Dr. Prashant said, if you stipulate it in your will, then something can be done about it after.
Yes, the advance directive that the daughter can do before she dies.
Okay. There was this whole talk about family human rights. Sharon, what did you think of that?
Well, technically, because here, in this particular case, the mother's arguing the human rights because it's disproportionate interference with the family's human rights, yeah? That's what the mother is arguing because that's what the daughter wanted, being was sort of last, you know, wishes. But that has to be balanced with the public because here... The word disproportionate interference has to be defined. It's not something that you think that just because someone wanted it and someone died of cancer, that technically alone. Because we are all sympathetic about it, but I don't think the law works on sympathy. So there are some rules that we have to follow, what actually means disproportionate. And Dr. Prashant highlighted the case, I think, or Dr. George, about Diana.
Yep.
Mm. Yeah. So there were three different decisions. Yeah. So... The difference between an embryo and an egg or sperm, the courts have treated these cases a bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
If it was an embryo, the court has taken a very strict approach where if one of the partner actually withdraws the consent, then no go.
All right. So it's just a matter of... This is like Evans versus United Kingdom, right?
Right. So that's the case that actually says no. Even though that lady had a very, you know, sympathetic case where she was actually desperate for a child... And she was already, cannot have it. So, but when it came to sperm and like Mrs. Blood, that was another case, that the court said, okay, fine. She circumvented the rules where she actually moved out of UK and went to Belgium. And she had two sons thereafter.
Mm.
Okay.
So you bypass, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to bypass to go to New York.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. But moving out is not really an issue. It's just about what are you trying to do? The consent, like Meera, you asked. The egg actually belongs to the daughter, and her consent form have to be specific, that storage, and if I die, what do I do with it? If you look at the consent form by HFE itself, it's very clear. What do I do with it? Do you donate it? Do you do something about it? Do you give it for research? So that's the position in this case, and because she was not clear, and consent has to be expressed, it cannot be deduced from the conversation that, you know, that has apparently happened between the mother and daughter.
Okay. So it's not common for surrogate mothers to be related to the donor then?
No.
Dr. Prashant?
No, generally not.
Why is that?
It's just simply because of the way things work. Most people go somewhere else, get a surrogate. I mean, it can be a sister. I've seen it happen between sisters. It works well. But in general, it becomes a commercial enterprise. So somebody finds a surrogate for you, is happy to carry that and go. So typically in places like India and Thailand, they are more or less the surrogate capitals of the world.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah, very much so.
It's our people.
Right. So, which is sad.
Yeah. Is there a reason for that?
Money buys everything. Mm. So if surrogate can get enough money to just get her family out of debt, educate all her children and pay her house off by just carrying one child after she's had six, why wouldn't she do it?
How does it work? I mean, does it mean that the embryo is just being carried in a plane by the owner and then go over there?
Well,
and then
finally, it was that simple. You can't buy these things at supermarket, George. George wants to be an IVF specialist. You know, he's always...
I'm really trying to find all these free knowledge.
But you know, Sharon, when you move...
You're posted by courier service to the later... Yeah.
When you talk, Sharon, when you talk about an embryo sperm or egg moving across borders, how does that work? There are legalities to it as well?
I mean, here, if a sperm or an egg, it's a property, and the property belongs to the person who's actually donated it or you know, whoever produced it. So moving a property, I would not see an issue, but it's just that what happens when the embryo becomes then a life force and baby is delivered, then the nationality issue becomes in the
country. Oh, now it's getting complicated.
But you see sperm and eggs are just property.
Right.
Sorry, okay. the property needs an import and export license.
It does.
Seriously?
You do. That's you why do. It's stuck. No, that's why it's stuck, and that's why Diane Blood is stuck, because the authorities are not giving them an export license to export the eggs.
All right. Because, I mean, Prashant, I presume you deal with things like this all the time,
we
right?
Do, yes.
Because, you know, you get...
Even in this country, you need a license.
To
import or export embryos. There are people who move from here to Singapore, for example.
That's right.
You could put it in your boot and carry it.
Right.
But if you want to do it legally, you need an export license from the government.
Right.
And you need an import license to do the same.
Mm-hmm. What did you think that the U.S. hospital is willing to do this?
Because there's no law in the U.S.
Sharon, you were talking about that. There's different laws in Europe, in the U.S. You want to shed more light on that?
I'm no expert in the U.S. law, but I can say that the U.K. is very conservative. I mean, look at what they have done to Evans. I mean, she was a very, in my opinion, she deserved to be a mum because, of, I mean, the partner just bolted on her in the last minute. But the U.K. being a position very conservative, I don't think they will ever condone these things.
Well, I mean, having said that, you said UK are, you know, very strict and very conservative. If you look at Diane Blood's case, right, I mean, essentially, the husband who had meningitis was in coma in ICU in UCH, and then the sperm was extracted without his consent, was kept. 3 years later, it was exported to Belgium, impregnated her. 16 years down the line, she has a 16-year-old kid. And the court actually was sympathetic towards Diane Blood. I mean, that's why I said there's a discrepancy between Mrs. M, which we were talking about here, and then on the other hand, Diane Blood actually had no consent in obtaining the sperm. What do you say about that?
Can you take sperm from without somebody's consent?
This is it, you see. I mean, here I'll draw the distinction. In the case that we're discussing, she had every opportunity to give consent, express consent. And she knew that there was a chance that she was going to die. And the only person she apparently spoke to was her mother to say, I want you to carry my baby. Now, sometimes when you die, you want to leave a legacy, but you have to discuss it with someone else. In the Diane Blood case, he went into a coma. If I'm not wrong, it was after an accident.
Meningitis.
Correct. So it was not something he'd planned.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a stable union with a wife, and they could demonstrate that they wanted to have a child. And he, through no fault of hers or his, suddenly ended up in a coma and died.
Mm.
So sperm was extracted, and the doctor said, we'll take it out, but you can't use it unless you get permission. But rather than, you know, you let the sperm go, we'll take it out, and then let the law decide. And the judges said, you've demonstrated that you were in a stable union, that you were going to have a child. And this man had no chance to give consent. It was that he never was in that situation. And they reasonably decided that had he been given that chance, chances are he would have said that he wanted his wife to have his children. So that was a little easier, the only sticking point being that there was no consent, but there was never an opportunity for it to give consent because he just slipped into a coma and that was it.
It's never straightforward, isn't it? You've got to take into account a whole load of issues surrounding the case.
That's what I said.
And no unit in UK would do it. And that's why she was wanting to export it to Belgium.
And she got the consent.
And she needed the consent because no unit was willing to export it either. No one was willing to carry it. And so she had to go to court to move it. Now, in another country, they would have just shut their eyes and given it to her and said, drive it, put it in the back of your boot and take it across. And that would have been that. You know, what is it from Britain to Belgium? It's, you know, get on Channel Tunnel or get on
there.
Do you think in Malaysia, you know, a lot of perhaps complicated situation like that happens a lot, but we don't kind of like... go to court, challenge it, and that sort of thing. We all have mutual, amicable agreement and say, okay, like, this is what we're going to do, with or without the consent of the law. Do you think that happens?
Not really.
Not really.
No, I think
Because the doctors are involved, because, you know, we will get into big trouble.
You will get into huge trouble, especially if, for example, Diane Blood's father-in-law happened to have been a very wealthy man with plenty of money and property. He could equally turn around and say, well, my son's dead. Where did these children come from? Because they're going to inherit my estate.
Yes.
And if, for example, he and his daughter-in-law didn't get on, he would have thought, well, that's the end. I'm not going to see her again. And there she turns up with two boys and says, now you've got to give me half your property.
Well,
so, you know, you are creating life and you have no consent for that. Yeah. Because the husband's dead. So it's a minefield. So most of us wouldn't touch it.
I mean, I want to ask Sharon about this because in late 90s, I was working at UCH and we were asked to find these devices that will generate artificial ejaculation. Basically, it's electrocuted.
That's a very interesting life.
And then we were supposed to find these devices, which is used in kind of like a... andrology department, and then suddenly the court were involved and said we're not allowed to use it, and then, you know, there were all sorts of things involved, and eventually we were quite glad because I was a junior doctor. You know, when I'm involved in this, you know, I probably have to stand in court to defend this. And eventually the court decided that, you know, they could go ahead. I mean technically that is an assault, isn't it, Sharon?
Well, yeah, if you do anything to a patient without their consent, it is.
I mean, Prashant was saying that they were in, you know, happy union. You know, they're happily married and sort of thing. And suddenly, bang, he was in coma because of meningitis. But irrespective of that, technically, to extract sperm out of somebody without his consent is an assault, right?
Well, because he didn't have the capacity to give consent. Now, he didn't have the capacity, isn't it? Because if he's in coma, then the issue of consent from someone who has got no capacity takes a different line. Here, I think, like what Dr. Prasad was telling, that the evidence from Mrs. Blood was that they've actually had discussed about the issue of sperm, the donation of the sperm, and it actually satisfied HIV's strict requirement. So I think the court, and further, this case actually maneuvered around the articles of the European Court to come to so that she could receive treatment. So it was not about... She actually circumvented the issue and got what she wanted. And I think it's quite interesting in this case because after the passing of her husband, they had difficulty naming the children's father.
Yes.
The law was changed in a haste to actually accommodate this. So I don't know, Mrs. Blood.
Is the son carries a name of Blood? And also what nationality? Belgium, British, or what?
That'll be British. Where he was born.
Well, he was born in Belgium.
Oh, people go to Bali on holiday, conceive in Bali, and deliver at KL. Let's not get into that, okay? This is beyond IVF.
We're talking about wherever the child was born.
No,
you have to call the child like Beckham's called Brooklyn.
So where was the child born? In the UK?
At
the end of the day, everybody just wanted this sperm exported. Because it was in the press and they just didn't want it. So they just wanted her out of the country with the sperm And she took it, went to Belgium, and that was the end of that. As far as the British system was concerned, you're out of my hair, it's somebody else's problem now.
Right, okay.
Because they hadn't exported an embryo. They only exported sperm. Yeah. They hadn't exported life. So the discussion was still around tissue and not life.
Yeah.
So if you can export a kidney, why can't you export sperm? Because you can make a baby out of it. Well, you can take a kidney and make a life out of it as well. So it's a very, very fine line.
But it's a separate life. It's a separate life with separate identity, with separate nationality. That's
if you have two failing kidneys and I give you a new one, it's my life. Right? It is a life. So it's a very fine line. And so the British system was just so happy to just get rid of it. So they said, take it and go on your way.
Okay, right.
And that was that.
Okay, you know, early on you mentioned about your near complicated case. I mean, Sharon, have you come across defending or fighting for any cases that is involving sperm, embryos or eggs in Malaysia? Do share with us.
No. I mean, at the best of my knowledge and my experience, no, I have never. And I don't think we have any reported decisions on this as well.
Right. I mean, at the moment...
We're even struggling with our act.
Yes, they are.
In what sense? Would you like to elaborate?
What act is this?
The artificial reproduction.
Okay.
There is an act.
It has been started since 2009, but there's a lot been. I think the stakeholders are actually having given the opinions. I don't think we have come to a consensus to even be able to draft a complete act.
Do you think we ever will?
Well, it's because of the complexity of multiracial and multi-religious society, right?
Yes, it is. It'll come. There is a strong desire on the part of ministry to have. We're one of the few countries in this area that don't have it. And so it is a glaring omission whenever you go. So there is a requirement. It will come, but it's taking a long time because there's just multiple views, all of which look at it from a different angle. And so you really have to, when you come in with a law, it has to be a consensus law. You can't have a law for one segment of society and not for another one and so on.
I'm going to come back and ask you about the fine line between science and religion, Dr. Prashant. Sharon, thank you.
Not so fine.
Thank you, Sharon, for joining us today.
You.
We'll go and we'll attack Dr. Prashant after this. thank you for joining us. There was Sharon Palania, medical legal lawyer, joining us from her office, talking to us about this whole idea of who owns the egg, a sperm or an embryo, based on the case we're discussing. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivisodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee and Dr. Prashant Nadkarni, fertility specialist, in the studio with us. We're discussing all the medical legal aspect of who owns an egg, who owns an embryo, who has rights over a sperm after the person has passed on, you know, that kind, those sort of issues. And this is based on a case in the UK where a girl who actually suffered from bowel cancer, who passed on, verbally told her mum that she wanted her mother to actually be the surrogate mother to her child. But the UK is not allowing it. And I think the big problem now is moving that egg to the US to a hospital that is happy to do that implantation on the mother. But that's not happening because the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority in the UK is not allowing to move that egg to the US. So we've got the lowdown as far as the legal aspects are concerned, but we have on the line with us Robert Tan. Robert, you have a question?
Yeah, hello. Good afternoon.
Hi, Robert.
Good afternoon.
Artificial insemination was freely available in Malaysia some 25 years ago. Now, it is still available nowadays.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Robert. Thanks.
The answer is yes. It depends on what he means by artificial insemination. If he means taking your partner's sperm and putting it into you at the time that you're fertile, yes, it's freely available. And that is what artificial insemination is. But in slang lingo, some people see artificial insemination as using donor sperm.
Mm.
If that's what he means, then yes, it is restricted.
Okay. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on donor sperm in Malaysia? What sort of restrictions?
Again, we work in the absence of law. So we work on the basis of guidelines. Some units still do that because they follow strict criteria and they do strict things like counseling and stuff, and they import standards from another unit overseas which is doing. The majority of us don't do it just because it's not...
It's complicated.
It's complicated and there is no law to protect you.
Right?
And sometimes in the absence of law when you do things, if there is a problem, then you get caught because you're there sitting on the stand. There's no law, and people say, "Oh, you know, the guideline says don't do it." Mm. If you've broken a guideline, yes, it's not against the law, but if there is a guideline, you can be held responsible.
Yeah, because you know, I always find this very complicated because I do come across many, many men due to mumps or cancer or something like that. Then eventually when we retrieve the sperms, they actually don't have any sperms. The only way for them to somehow have one half of their spouse's genetic material to pass on is a donor sperm. And they always ask me many questions, you know, where can I get donor sperms? And then who will be the donors? What sort of characteristics do you know? How much do they know about me? What sort of test do you run? And then, so you know, how safe is it? And that sort of thing. And it's very complicated.
It's very complicated.
Yeah.
Well, it's done professionally in Australia and all of that.
Yeah,
right?
In many countries.
They have sperm banks.
Oh, yes.
But in Malaysia, I think because of the complexity and also there's no strict law to provide protections. Many doctors will just kind of say, look, I don't want to get involved.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fine line between science and religion.
You know, when you do things as well, you do it in good faith and you expect that, or you would like to do it within the law so that if there is a problem, there are set precedents and set things to follow. Now, if you do it in the absence of a law to protect you, you just never know what the outcome's going to be. So sometimes it's just best to keep away.
Okay. We have a question here. What happens to a Muslim sperm if it's surrogate in a non-Muslim female? The non-Muslim lady is not married to the sperm donor. What would happen to the child
in
this country?
In Islam, it's very simple. Islam's actually very clear in terms of what it is. A child is to be born by a husband and a wife, and there should be no third person. And that's the end of that. So
surrogacy is completely unacceptable.
Egg donation is out and sperm donation out. It's very easy to understand.
So in Islam, that is clear-cut?
Clear-cut.
Okay. In Catholicism?
Catholicism is even stricter. Mm-hmm. They don't like the idea of IVF.
Right, okay.
So Catholicism, not the new churches, but Catholicism as such, for many years has opposed IVF on the basis that the whole act is unnatural. It's outside the body.
Right.
So even IVF itself is seen as you know, unethical.
Mm.
Whereas in Islam, it's as long as you're having a child from the husband and wife, it's actually good to do because, you know, you're supposed to populate the earth.
Yeah, I mean, in Catholic beliefs, I mean there are changes. Like, for example, recently, Zika virus, the Pope actually said something along the line of, you know, possibly, you know.
So there has been a compromise. Now, you know, the church also faces pressures.
That's right.
In Italy, huge pressures. If you can't have a child, and the Vatican's there, and the Vatican says, don't do IVF, what are you supposed to do? So there has been a compromise. And the big issue, which you can understand, that the particularly that the Vatican is concerned about, is throwing away frozen embryos. So, you know,
that's throwing away life.
Yes. So you collect 10 eggs, you make 4 embryos, you put 2 back, couple has 1 or 2 children, then they say, we don't want any more. Do you throw them away? It's life. So they've come to a compromise now where in Italy you can do IVF, and this went through a referendum. You can do IVF, but you can only use 2 eggs at a time.
Right.
So you only make the number of embryos that you're going to put back. And since you don't put back
you're not allowed to freeze the rest.
You can freeze an egg, so you can collect 6 eggs, but make 2 embryos at a time in every cycle.
Right.
And leave the rest frozen. So, you know, an egg is...
Am I right to believe that embryos are more stable for freezing compared to eggs?
It used to be. It used to be, and that used to be the big problem. I mean, why would you freeze embryos if you could freeze eggs?
Mm.
It's just in the last 5 years that techniques have improved, and now egg freezing is almost as good as embryo freezing. Remember that we also look at long-term data.
Mm.
The world's oldest frozen embryo baby is now 32 years old.
Right.
The world's oldest frozen egg baby, and there's just a handful, are still just touching puberty.
Right.
In any numbers. So you really don't have long-term data. So you don't want to do something that you're not sure of.
Because that will change a lot of landscape of modern-day living,
yes,
right? Because, you know, so many women would decide that they... one of the reasons why they're pressurized is because of this biological clock.
Yes.
So everybody would, if the technique is very good, and everybody will freeze their eggs well in advance.
Increasingly. We're seeing women quite regularly who come and freeze eggs with us. And it's all over the world. So if a woman gets to her early 30s or mid-30s and there's no partner in sight or doesn't want to start a family just yet, a lot of film stars do it in Hollywood.
Yeah.
They freeze their eggs, then they go away, do what they're doing, earn the academy, and then come back 10 years later and use their frozen eggs and have
babies. They're probably the role models, actually, for all of this.
Mm-hmm. You can see Mira kind of going, rolling her eyes, going, my goodness.
You know, they underestimate their role. You know, people emulate.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they think it's the right thing to go, the right way to go. You mentioned there's a different cost between freezing eggs and sperms. Why is that?
Sperm is very easy to freeze.
Why is that?
Because there's too many.
It's just a technology.
You just put in a fridge, will be all right.
Yeah, you know, we just have a...
No, don't try it at all. Don't listen to him.
The techniques are very, very different. It's very time-consuming.
Right.
Sperm is very stable. Eggs are, by nature, very unstable. And so because they're unstable, you have to be very careful how you freeze them and how you thaw them. The egg is also a huge cell. It's about 600 times the size of a sperm. So just to give you an example, if you were to freeze a Coke bottle, you put it in your freezer or a wine bottle, and you took it out the next morning, about a quarter of the time that bottle would have burst.
Yeah.
Right. Sperm doesn't do that. Eggs do that. It because of ice crystals. Now, ice crystals in eggs can damage the genetics. And that's why egg freezing took so long to get right, because you kept getting ice crystals in eggs, and they either burst or they damaged the chromosomes in there, and you just didn't get proper embryos. So it was, for many years, hit and miss with frozen eggs. It either worked or it didn't, and most times it didn't work. These days, with new technologies, it's very, very good.
Fantastic. Wow. George and I are like fixated. Tell us more. You know, just tell us more.
Well, I think it would change the whole landscape of how...
I'm sure it already has, doesn't it?
Real fertility, you know.
In the West, it has. There's increasing awareness. We used to do it only for people facing cancer therapy.
Mm.
But now it's actually become, they call it social freezing. It's become... I wouldn't say it's become the norm, but certainly it's a thought that a lot of women have, career women. They know about it, they've heard about it, and many of them do it. Certainly in the States, there are clinics specifically for egg freezing.
Fantastic.
Wow, yeah. I love that idea. Yeah. Social freezing.
Social freezing.
That's right.
And I just learned something new, artificial ejaculation. Heard of premature.
Roger,
of
okay, you never heard of it?
No, I haven't.
So you should do more shows.
I should.
maybe twice a week, I'll tell you
social
more.
Social freezing. Oh, dear. Okay. You know, just before we conclude, and while we're on that note about social freezing, we are actually organizing BFM's first Health and Living Live 2016. What is it? It's our first on-ground event. We're actually taking the health show to the ground on the 2nd of April. Details will be up next week on the BFM website. But both of you are going to be a part of this show.
Oh, we're invited.
Yes.
So we haven't put you off.
And the title of your panel discussions, we're going to have many panel discussions, and yours is one of them.
Right.
The title of your panel discussion is titled Aging Eggs and the Sperm Count Crisis.
Oh, so that's right. So it was very appropriate to talk about
Absolutely.
All these aging eggs
and
what to do.
Joining the both of you will also be Dr. Premita Damodaran, the obstetrician gynecologist, who will be part of this discussion as far as women's health is concerned. So keep yourselves free, 2nd of April.
I think there will be lots of people interested because, you know, fertility is a very, very
emotive.
Taboo.
Emotive. It's very emotive.
Extremely.
Yes. Extremely. I mean, just come.
George is getting worked up.
It's emoting
your fist. Yes.
Come, listen to them, ask questions. I mean, we're opening up the floor for anyone to ask questions if you like. Ask a friend to ask the question if you're not comfortable asking the question. So look out for that space next week on our BFM website. Your photographs will be up.
You know, for many, many years, for the last 7-8 years, I've been thinking that I can get away with the radio face, that I don't have to appear on the stage. Now I have to lose weight now to appear on that.
You have a month.
No choice. I've got a month.
Botox.
Yes, we just did a show on that.
Yeah,
show.
Yeah, we have lunchtime. Lunchtime Botox, social freezing.
Yes, absolutely.
The new world.
That's right.
How would you like to conclude, Dr. Prashant, for today's show?
Well, I think, as I always say, science moves at the speed of light. And from our point of view, if you can think it, you can do it. It's a matter of whether ethics can, and society can accept what we do. And this discussion is very, very important, because otherwise you'd be doing all sorts of things that, you know, science or society wouldn't accept. So I actually like the idea that this discussion goes on somewhere in the world, because whatever England decides or Britain decides, the rest of the world is going to adopt or think about it. And number two, I hope that our legislation comes in soon so that all of us have some framework to work in.
Fantastic. George?
Well, I really like this case because it starts a conversation. I really think these are the things, like Dr. Prashant was saying, that the signs move on and our ethics and our view has to change as well in some way. And this is a self-reflection. And I really think, I really hope many people will join us in the conversation in our health event, because this is the sort of things to get people interested and to spread awareness.
Yeah. It's open to all of you to come, so keep yourselves free. 2nd April, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Where is it going to be?
Nexus at Bangsa, Connection Bangsa South. It's only going to cost you 50 ringgit.
Oh, it's
not
it
a lot. No, it's not free. It's just 50 ringgit. So, you know. So, yes, you will get a goodie bag. Okay.
Yeah, 70 ringgit worth of gifts. It's not bad.
You may be able to get some screening done here and there. You know, we have you know, our sponsors setting up booths. So, come and have fun. Listen to all our doctors. Meet them. Put a face to the voices. And we'd love to meet you.
Yeah.
So fantastic. Thank you both very much for coming in today.
Welcome.
Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Prashant Nadkarni, fertility specialist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.